there may be 34 states now that do have some form of safe harbor law. And what that means is that if, let's say, a girl is in one of these situations, you know, a young lady's in a really bad situation, she's arrested as a 14-year-old or 15-year-old for prostitution, and if she's in a safe harbor law state, they can erase that charge. If she's not, then she's going to have that on her record. She'll have a prostitution charge in her record. It's going to make it difficult for her to get a job. It's going to make it difficult for her to even rent an apartment. It's a really problematic issue that we're sort of putting responsibility on kids, basically, for the situation that they're put in, rather than giving the benefit of the doubt and giving them a chance to do something better. Your face. I need to know you're here. All the lies can disappear. Now, more than ever, I need to feel you near. Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we are back with the second part of a two-part series on the subject of sex trafficking or human trafficking. This episode is a little different, as I alluded to last week. This one is more focused on what is happening and occurring within the United States at this point in time. And it's a different perspective. So the guest I have on this week, I was very excited to speak with. He had reached out a while back about a book he had coming out. The book is called The Outcast Daughter, What I Learned About Hope and Faith from Conversations with Sex Trafficking Survivors. And he also has a documentary film out. You can find it on Amazon and some other places, but it's called Irreclaimable. And I sat down, I read the book, watched the documentary. It was very powerful. For one thing, it's he talks to a lot of the survivors in person, so there's a lot of different perspectives. And it just goes to show just how many different ways in which women and oftentimes, unfortunately, young girls are pulled into this industry. And there are a lot of different methods that are used by sex traffickers to bring these women into the industry, and oftentimes, you know, against their will. And so it's scary. It's oftentimes some of the stories that are told in the book and in the documentary are hard to listen to, but I think necessary, because it is a subject, I think, that a lot of people just aren't familiar with. And oftentimes, myself included, and Justin even mentions this as well, you know, just the idea that, you know, this is something that doesn't happen in the United States. You know, we're this first world power, and we're so civilized and all that sort of thing. And, you know, this is something that happens in third world countries. You know, we see this in the news happening elsewhere, but that's not true at all. And in fact, I believe, if I remember the statistic correctly, and we call this out in the episode, something like $9.8 billion of revenue comes from the sex trafficking industry in the United States of America, and it impacts an estimated 100,000 girls. That is horrifying. So it is a problem. It is very much a problem here at home as well as abroad. And so the problem is happening everywhere. It's one of the fastest growing sources of commerce in the world right now. And that's a real problem, obviously. So hopefully between this last episode and this episode, you know, we've presented some ways and some organizations that are doing some excellent work that if you have the means, you can help get behind financially. You know, being at the times as they are right now, if the financial aspect is not a possibility, completely understandable. At the very least, what we need to do is get the message out about this this issue and help spread the word and keep it in the public consciousness, so that way, you know, we can find solutions to this problem. And as we talked about in the last episode, as we talk about in this episode, it's kind of a multifold solution. You know, there's legislation that can be created, and some that has been created but doesn't exist in all states across the United States. So there's the legislative approach to it. There's the public education. There's the education of law enforcement when they come into contact with not only the women who are pulled into the sex trafficking industry, but also, you know, the pimps and the solicitors that are involved in this as well, that help prop up this industry and keep it running. You know, there's aftercare being a big one, a huge one. So, you know, one of the things that really was eye-opening was where we talk about the fact that, like, think about the amount of psychological care that someone would need after experiencing sexual assault or rape. Could be a lifetime of psychological treatment involved. And then, as I believe Justin said to me, now think about that on a different scale. You know, think about a woman who has been raped repeatedly every single day for years, and just how much care that would involve. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. It's unbelievable. And so, you know, for those of you that live in the United States, we, you know, you guys probably know, if you've listened to this podcast for a while, that I'm a huge proponent of mental health. And unfortunately, the mental health system, as it's set up currently in the United States, is not great. Therapy is and can be very expensive. And out of reach for a lot of people, you know, especially if you don't have insurance, or if the insurance only covers a certain amount of sessions, it can be very difficult. And so you can imagine somebody who is working in the sex trade or the sex trafficking industry, who doesn't have insurance, who barely has a place to live, you know, this becomes extremely difficult. And there aren't things set up and set in place to help provide that level of counseling, to help provide job skills, training, and things of that nature. So there are some organizations, there are some people who are doing that work out there trying to get those things in place. So, but it can't happen without support, and it can't happen without the voice of the people pushing that forward. So I hope this series was beneficial and was hopefully eye-opening for folks who weren't familiar with it. And hopefully it you know, for those of you who want to help, hopefully it's provided you with some opportunity and some resources to really help with this. So, having said that, again, this is, I think, a really eye-opening conversation for me. This one really focuses on what's happening here at home. And so, you know, Justin Toppins, if I haven't mentioned his name already, the book and the documentary are outstanding. So go check those out. There's a lot of really gut-wrenching and heartbreaking stories in there, but very, very important, because they really kind of shattered what I thought I knew about it. And so one of the statistics I want to give, and this is one that's in the book, is approximately 1 in 5 homeless young adults have been trafficked or felt that they had no choice but to trade sex for food, shelter, or money. 22% were approached by a pimp to sell sex during their very first night of homelessness. Of young people who reported engaging in any commercial sex, 54% experienced prior sexual abuse. The study also shows the disproportionate prevalence of trafficking among LGBTQ youth, representing 39% of those exploited. Those are horrific statistics, but these are the facts. And so, so again, hopefully this moves you in a way that pushes you to want to help at the very least to spread the word. So again, Justin Toppins, great conversation with him. He's doing amazing work and bringing light to this topic. So go out and support his work. I will have, of course, the links in the show notes. You know, like I said, check out the documentary and the book. I think the two complement each other very nicely. There's some additional information in the book that isn't in the film, and vice versa. So I think the two go hand in hand quite well. Go out and support the music on this episode. David Zach, the lead singer of Remedy Drive, who was on last week's episode, that his band is featured again on this episode. So go out and support Remedy Drive, Exodus Road, and all the different organizations that are helping with this issue. So, if you want to keep up with what we are up to, you can go to www.thedeconstructionist.com. We have a blog there. We have links to our social media. We have all of our back catalog of episodes there that you can listen to straight from the website. Additionally, you can link to our Patreon. So if you want to support us there, we have various packages. Our most popular one happens to be our book club, where we select a book of the month and we send that book to you. And we have some other fun stuff on there too. We will be updating our web store shortly, but we do have a bunch of different t-shirt designs, pint glasses, coffee mugs, all sorts of good stuff. So yeah, hopefully by this point, at the time this episode comes out, hopefully our web store will have been updated and we'll have some new blog stuff up there. What else? Just as a reminder, working with a new platform right now. So very excited about some cross promotional opportunities. So you may hear some little commercials for similar podcasts. So if you like what we're doing, go out and support the podcast that we happen to be promoting. And then also you may see hear some ad reads here shortly, just for some products, some businesses that have decided to support us and sponsor us, and businesses that we can get behind. If that product sounds appealing to you, go out and check it out, and we will always have a discount code available to you. So without further ado, let's get to this week's episode. Again, hope you like it, and next week we'll be back with another episode. So without further ado, Justin freaking Toppins. Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. Really excited tonight to have on the podcast Justin Toppins. Welcome and thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So before we get into it, because it's kind of doing a little series here this month on this particular topic, but tell people a little bit about yourself, what you do for a living, and kind of your faith background.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was raised evangelical. I worked as a youth intern in two churches, and I attended Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky for about a year. I started, I think systematic theology is maybe what got me initially, and I started kind of having some doubts there. I left seminary. I moved to California, where I met a girl who would become my wife years later. She worked in television production, and I moved back to Nashville, and then she moved out here. And for a while, I had been kind of talking to her about possibly working on a documentary or some type of production together. And she always kind of put it off. But, the documentary was how I was able to get her, involved.
Very cool. And by the way, Nashville is one of my absolute favorite cities. Your coffee game there is very strong. So, I need to get back down
it
there.
Is. It's
things
very
settle
strong.
Down. I'm telling you, every time I go there, I go to a different place and it's always good.
Yeah. And they keep popping up. I mean, it seems like there's a new one every week, but
it's a good problem. We love
it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you met your wife out in California, you guys come back. She's involved, as you said, in the TV industry. And so you wanted to work on this project together. How did you come to find, the topic of sex trafficking or human trafficking? How did you, come about choosing that as the topic of this project?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think the way that it started was, even though I was not, I felt like if I wasn't sure that God existed, I probably didn't need to be in seminary. But I was still, there was a church that I found that was, willing to, open to asking questions. I loved the people that taught there, and we would go to this bar in Knoxville that would have like a movie night where they would project movies onto this brick wall in the bar there. And we would all sort of just hang out and eat pizza, just people in the college group there. And there was right across the street from the bar, there was this kind of like a little bit more risque bar, I guess. And I knew it was there. I'd never been growing up in the area, but when I did move back to Nashville, I happened to come across an article about this girl who had been sexually trafficked out of that bar. And when I was talking about potentially, speaking to someone, I told my wife, I was like, I've got to reach out to her. So I sent her an email, and she responded to it. And we actually met for coffee right on the same street that bar was in. And it was crazy for me because I said in the book, it was like, it hit me that, she and I are the same age, and we had been on that same street at the same time several nights, and just, it kind of made it more real for me how close this problem is for us.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things, I think, in this, I'll be honest, this was me as well, just my ignorance to the subject, just in terms of how, like you said, how close it is. I just always assumed that it was something that happened in a far off country, some third world country somewhere. This isn't a problem that happens in America. Was that kind of your perception as well? Like what kind of misconceptions did you learn as you started to interview these people for the both the book and the film?
Well, those two points, absolutely. I had that misconception that it's definitely an international problem. I knew that it was an issue in Southeast Asia, just from other people that I had spoken with. But what I didn't, two misconceptions that I had were the location of the problem being down the street, and the other being how people got involved. Because I had always assumed that people just make bad decisions, put themselves in bad situations. And the way that, I would perceive a pimp growing up was just what I saw on TV. That's something that women kept saying to me when we were doing these interviews, is that's completely inaccurate. A lot of traffickers actually will talk to boys in high schools and have them talk to young ladies that they know are struggling. They have access to the internet, and people post a lot of things on Facebook, a lot of things on Instagram when they're having a hard time, and they actually target those individuals, and they make a lot of promises, which you can several books on that topic of girls who were struggling, had a difficult home life, maybe mom and dad weren't home, and people would say, hey, let me take you out and shop for you. And that was the kind of a reoccurring theme with how women who are young women who were struggling, people would target those because they were more vulnerable. It wasn't this thing where, a young woman just decides that she wants to work as a prostitute. I think that's what we see sometimes in the media when people want to project the image that it's a victimless crime. But the majority of people are not in situations like that. You said you read the book. You remember there's a story Tawan McCarty talks about how as a runaway, a pimp found her, and she was, he was giving her drugs to sell on the street corner. She didn't have to, prostitute herself, but, she says that she thought she was more important to him. And she was like, I think 15, 16 at the time, maybe even younger than that. But, they had every woman in that house had a quota in terms of how much money they had to bring back. And she tells the story and tears up when she told us that he basically gave her a limited supply of drugs to distribute on a given night. And she knew that that was her cue, that she was going to have to find another way to make that quota to avoid being, beaten in front of everybody. So I think that it changed my perspective, not just on where this problem exists, but the system that is used to sort of enslave people because it's not chained. They're more psychological.
Yeah, I think that was an eye-opener for me as well. This idea, I remember one of the women you interviewed talking about the fact that it's not always girls who are like living off the streets. It's people who are being recruited, as you said, in high schools. And it's not always by a stranger that approaches you, but rather sometimes it's people that you know or even family members. And I thought, what? That's insane.
Yeah.
But some of the stories they told, that was exactly what happened. And so like the theme that I kept seeing was is that these traffickers were taking advantage of a situation where, as you said, sometimes they had a bad home life situation, or they were desperate and needed to make money to be able to pay rent or put food on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to. I mean, I can't imagine. I have kids, and the thought that some of these people. I mean, one story that really got to me was one of the young ladies we interviewed was raped by someone in her high school, and she pressed charges, and her stepfather actually kicked her out of the house because of the race of the person who raped her. I mean, like the situations, like it's heartbreaking to think that there's nobody filling that gap. So that was one of the things that put out to me at the end of this is we have to do more just as individuals, but as society, to sort of figure out how we can help people like that and just give them options. Because the thing is, if I know that you said we would touch on this later, but I think in a case like that, what I didn't realize is, if let's say that a girl is trafficked at 15 or 16 years old, if she has a prostitution charge, in a lot of states, she's not even going to be able to rent an apartment, much less get a job. And so what is she supposed to do from there besides go right back into this horrible line of work that she doesn't want to be a part of in the first place? But her options are very limited because of the way that the law treats her.
Oh, man. Go a little further with that, because one of the things that I just wasn't aware of was this thing called safe harbor laws, and the fact that the laws are very different depending on what state you reside in. And that seems to be one of the issues in terms of really truly doing anything substantial about this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the biggest issues, actually, because when at the time we were doing the research, and there were 30, there may be 34 states now that do have some form of safe harbor law. And what that means is that if, let's say a girl is in one of these situations, a young lady's in a really bad situation, she's arrested as a 14-year-old or 15-year-old for prostitution. And if she's in a safe harbor law state, they can erase that charge. If she's not, then she's going to have that on her record. She'll have a prostitution charge in her record. It's going to make it difficult for her to get a job. It's going to make it difficult for her to even rent an apartment. It's a really problematic issue that we're sort of putting responsibility on kids, basically, for the situation that they're put in, rather than giving the benefit of the doubt and giving them a chance to do something better. I don't know at this point how, as more states adopt these types of laws, it seems like we should be addressing it at a more federal level, because none of the people that I interviewed benefited from safe harbor laws. And it is something that we've just been giving attention to. I think the DA here in Nashville told us it's only really been addressed in the last 10 to 12 years, but it needs to definitely be something that everybody is aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk a little bit about, because my thought while I was reading the book and watching the documentary, and just the more I kind of educated myself on the subject, was that you're absolutely right. It oftentimes seems like these women are, well, girls in many cases, because a lot of them are underage, are starting off at essentially a deficit. You know, a lot of them, I remember one of the comments in the, I think it was in the documentary by one of the women you interviewed, was that a lot of these women who end up in the sex trade are women or girls who had been sexually assaulted in some form or fashion earlier in their lives and didn't have a support system in place, and therefore were perhaps a little more vulnerable when someone, you know, like a sex trafficker came along and are offering them things to fill that need or that void that they had.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think, I, you know, one thing I thought about after all of this, and it didn't, I mean, it was probably a year after you were done with the documentary, somebody brought up this idea. There was a hashtag on Twitter, like the Church2 hashtag. Have you heard of that? Familiar with that?
A little bit, yeah.
So when I had listened to, I have a friend here who does an LGBTQ podcast, and they kept, in this one interview, they were discussing how sort of like the purity culture that we have in churches, we sort of tell young girls that if they're, you know, not virgins when they get married, they're not valuable, or at the very least, they're less valuable, you know? And I think I guess what was hard for me to see is that that's a problem across the board, that it's not in faith communities. We still devalue those girls. It's not just something that is occurring to the girl who has an absentee father, an absentee mother. But I mean, absolutely the resources need to be better. But I think what hit me was that we need to sort of change our perspective as a culture on how we look at it. It's very much, what I felt is like a commodification of women in general, if that makes sense. That's the thing that stuck with me the most, hearing those stories, particularly of those young girls, because they just felt their value was non-existent. And if there's a lady that I interviewed, I would definitely encourage your listeners to check out. Her name was Kelly Alsobrook. Do you remember that part?
Yeah.
That talking with her, because she is very adamant that like kids really just need one person to sort of instill value in them and let them know they're loved. And she feels it would prevent a large number of kids being even susceptible to traffickers. I know that's a long-winded answer, but.
No, that I remember that part. It stuck out to me because she was saying, you know, she was really emphasizing the fact that, you know, a lot of this stems from the fact that a lot of these women don't see value in themselves in the first place. And so, you know, a lot of them are kind of, I guess, readily susceptible to someone coming along and saying, oh yeah, you know, like pretending to care about them until they're trapped, essentially. And a lot of these women are in fact trapped, exactly that. Like I remember in the documentary, one of the women talking about the fact that, and I think you asked her too, she said that she was taken all over the United States. And I think you asked like, well, how does that work? And so talk about that a little bit, because that was completely eye-opening for me.
Yeah, that was eye-opening for me too. Because that was the Tawan interview, and she's somebody who, I mean, up until very recently, has been known as one of the biggest advocates for sex trafficking survivors in the world. I mean, she had established a rescue in Birmingham that would take women and their children if they had children, because she found out that there weren't any place for those people to go. But her story was basically that she's the same woman we had just talked about earlier who was sort of forced to prostitute herself by her pimp. And when we were talking, and I asked her, I said, well, how does it work if you're traveling, you know, if you're having to be taken across the country? Because this is back when, you know, prior to Backpage really being taken down.
Before you keep going, explain what Backpage is, because I'm sure, like me, a lot of our listeners are like, what is that? It's a website, first of all. Explain what that website was supposed to do and I think they just took it down, right? If I remember correctly.
Yes. Yeah, the government got involved to take it down, but if it were not so horrible, it's a fascinating story because it was actually when I went to. So first of all, I'll back up and say Backpage is a directory website, or it was a directory website, basically for different types of services. It most resembled Craigslist, to be honest. I think probably most of your listeners would be pretty familiar with Craigslist, but Backpage allowed, massage services and like escort services to be posted on their site. And there was a lot of legal issues. I know you said you read the book, and I actually pointed out at one point that Backpage had fought in court to prevent women who post, or supposedly, because a lot of times it wasn't the women, it was their pimps. They were putting pictures of them up on Backpage, but they actually fought in court to keep the women's ages off of the site, which is unbelievable. Because I understood the idea that a lot of prostitutes were saying that using a website like that made it slightly safer from them, because they did have a paper trail, or at least an electronic paper trail of who they were communicating with. But when I found that out, that was I was pretty much done with Backpage and the process of making that documentary. And, you know, when I went to the Museum of Modern Slavery in Houston, Texas, as part of this documentary, which is really fascinating. That's it's run by Elijah Rising, which is another advocacy group for sex trafficking survivors. And they actually pointed out in the tour that in the 2008 bailout, Backpage was a recipient of the government bailout, which was crazy.
Yeah.
But back to your question about Tawan, you know, she told me basically, I said, where do you go? Like, how does it work if you're being, you know, sold multiple times a day and you're traveling all across the country? And the way that she described it, which is, you know, basically going to, say she starts in Birmingham, and then they would drive her up to Nashville, and they would go to three or four hotels in Nashville. They would advertise her, they would sell her, and then they would drive to Memphis, and they would advertise her in Memphis, and they would sell her in Memphis, and then they would drive to Little Rock or wherever was next. And that day she told us that she had been sold. I don't want to misquote her, but I believe she said she had been sold in every state outside of Hawaii and Alaska.
Oh my gosh. If you're a ship and you're lost in the ocean, be the wind in your sails, give you motion. I will guide you home. If you're too far out that you can't see the shoreline, be the light now shining in the nighttime. That's insane. And so, one of the distinctions you make in the book, though, and I think this is probably a good time to kind of talk about that a little bit, but talk a little bit about the distinction between what is commonly viewed as someone who's engaged in prostitution versus what would be considered sex trafficking.
Yeah, that's something when I started the process and I had talked to Angie, and the way that the documentary actually happened is I met Angie, I spoke with her, and she said, have you met Tawan McCarty? And I said, I have not. And she said, you should go talk to her. And talk to Tawan, and she said, have you met Kelly Alsobrook? You should go talk to her. And so they sort of, there's a close-knit community of those survivors. And it occurred to me that, you know, also, there were probably women who were not necessarily trafficked, or at least aware that they were trafficked. They were still working in prostitution. And I wanted to get at least someone's opinion from that side as well. So I did meet a girl named Amber in Memphis. And I think me and maybe two, you know, like a camera guy and a sound guy, we went out and spent 2 days with her and loved her. She was one of our favorite conversations. She's a just a really kind person. And her story, you know, even though she was still, and I assume it's still working in prostitution, you know, was that she got a job in a massage parlor and found that she could make extra money with sexual services and then kind of went from there. And, you know, she doesn't work with a pimp or anything like that. But her, you know, even in her situation, when I asked her, you know, why do you keep doing it? You know, it seems like everybody that we've talked to is they want out, you know, they would do anything to just have another job so they wouldn't have to do this. And, you know, and I think if you saw the documentary and, they included at the end that she, you know, she's paying for her daughter's husband, her grandkids all live with her. And she, you know, gets up, takes her grandkids to church on Sundays. It's just, it still seems to me, if she had another option, another way, she may potentially, not want to work, as an escort. But I think, you know, certainly there are women that choose to stay in the industry for a variety of reasons, but it seems like from the people that I spoke with, even just corresponded with it's mostly a money issue.
Yeah, that seemed to be a common tie that popped up a lot, or women who were in dire financial straits. I remember one of the women that you interviewed talked about the fact that I think she was the one that started out in a strip club, and her car broke down, and she was like, you know, what am I supposed to do? You know, it seems like these are women who have very few, if any, options at all, and are, you know, commonly in dire financial situations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so hard. And that, you know, that was Angie, and she was another one that I really just enjoyed talking with the days that we spent with her. And we talked, you know, since then. But, you know, she now actually has a ministry where she goes out and just delivers fresh baked cookies to prostitutes and things like that. And she had one of my favorite quotes the entire documentary where, you know, she said there was a lady she would speak with who said, "There's a new girl, you should meet her." And she met this 18-year-old girl who just started working as a street prostitute in Knoxville. And she would sit and talk with her and bring her dinner. And she said, I felt Jesus more in those conversations than I ever did in a church pew. And because she was so, I knew she was, that's how she really felt. That was one of the more poignant moments for me, I think, in the entire documentary.
Wow. Talk a little bit about, this is, I think, was one of the hardest stories to hear in the documentary, but I think it's a poignant moment that just points out just how many different ways sex traffickers are able to recruit girls and women. And it was a story about one of the women who, one of her, I would use air quotes, friends, took her to a party, and she got into, I think, a drinking match with somebody, and next thing she knew, she woke up on the bathroom floor, and this happened a couple times, and you know, before she ends up essentially trapped in a situation where two guys are basically like, "Yep, you're in this now," and there's no going back.
Yeah, and that's and you know where we were just to go back real quick to what we talked about earlier. About this issue of self-esteem and what we tell young girls, that the girl you're talking about is the same girl, whose father had kicked her out of the house, her stepfather had kicked her out of the house. But yeah, she, you know, a recruiter for a trafficker sort of befriended her and, you know, said she would drive up to Chicago and, you know, buy clothes and shoes and just kind of whatever she wanted. And, she invited her to a party, and she was drinking with the guy at the party, and he said, I could drink you into the table. And she said, I wanted to feel like an adult, and I told him he couldn't. And she got drunk and sort of blacked out and woke up in a bathroom with, I believe she said, a dozen used condoms in the bathroom. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to even tell these stories, you know, much less imagine that these women actually went through things like that.
Yeah, and I think the other piece of this that was, I think, equally as difficult to hear is just, and I think you kind of commented on it earlier, because I think a lot of people are like, well, when these horrifying things happen, why don't these women just go to the police? But there seems to be a very good reason based on some of the stories I remember hearing and reading for them not going to the police. So talk about that a little bit and how the system is just not set up to help these women.
Yeah, it's, you know, we didn't screen the documentary that many places, John, but I thought at one place I felt safe screening the documentary was in Knoxville, my hometown, because it's not, you know, I knew a lot of people there. We kind of set it up in advance, and there's one of the women in the story talks about how she works with police departments to make them aware of how to talk to prostitutes, because if a police officer walks into a brothel or they do a bust, they don't have any idea whether that woman is a willing working prostitute or whether she is a sex trafficking victim. And she said that every time she goes to a police department, she physically shakes for the first couple minutes because she has memories of being, you know, raped by police officers who arrested her. And then when we were at Elijah Rising in Houston, there was another really good conversation we had with this about them, where she talked about how a lot of women are afraid. If, you know, you imagine that someone knocks down the door of a brothel and the police come in and they're arresting everybody. For the most part, all of those women are being told by the traffickers that the police are the enemy. Right? They're going to arrest you. They're going to put you in jail. It's going to be on your record. And also you do what we say or else. You know, I mean, the traffickers have the power normally to make statements like that. And so what they're trying to do with Elijah Rising as part of their advocacy is talking to the police department in Houston, Texas, and saying, when you walk into a situation like this, just initially try to show these women some compassion and hear them out, because they have no ability, even if we change the law and make the law more accessible to them. If a girl is too afraid to say that she was trafficked at the age of 16 and she's now 19 or whatever she is, and she's being arrested, she's not going to be able to even access those laws. So there's definitely an educational element for the police department. And I think the only reason I brought up the documentary is because when that part of the documentary, was playing and we were discussing these issues with the police department, we actually had people walk out, which blew me away.
Wow.
Because you would think that, you know, people would be willing to say whatever it takes, to help someone who's, I mean, we would never condone slavery, right? But, there's something, there's still a little bit of a hardness, about reaching out to, these women in particular. And I think, I mean, I understand it because, you know, growing up, where I grew up, and I'm thankful for everything about my upbringing, but, you know, I would definitely see them as having done something wrong. And that was one of the things that changed for me the most, was sitting down and having these one-on-one conversations and making friends, you know? And I think that's what they're trying to stress to, you know, police departments, is just treating these women as human beings first, and then, you know, begin your assessment of the situation.
Yeah. One of the other parts that I remember vividly is the part where a lot of the women were talking about the fact that so often the women are the ones getting arrested, and it's the pimps and the Johns. And for those who don't know, John's just a term for a man soliciting a prostitute. But the pimps and the clients, if you will, are not the ones who are suffering the consequences. I think there's even a part where you're at the museum where they had a piece of a wall that had been spray painted that said something along the lines of, "You got my girls, but you didn't get me."
Yeah. That was, I mean, you know, I don't know how graphic I could be or not be, but
go for it. go for it.
You know, that there was a cantina, is what they call them, in Houston, that they actually busted up, and that's where they found that. And the police had that. The traffickers had wrote that on some wood they had used to board up the building. And with all the cantinas they busted up, this particular cantina, they found discarded fetuses outside and trash cans. I mean, the way that those women were treated is just completely inhuman. But as an issue where you know, when you talk about the Johns being, you know, sort of certainly facing less consequences, I do want to talk about that, because there's, you know, there's a couple of different ways to address that. And, there's a woman here in Nashville who used to work for the DA's office, and she started a program that's called the John School. And you can find, if you just Google John School, you'd find, you know, several of them. There's one in Seattle, Washington. I think they're starting one in Atlanta. And it's a great alternative, because what they basically do is take men who are soliciting prostitution, and they give them the option to have their first charge expunged if they go through a John School. So they'll pay money to go and hear prostitutes talk about how difficult their situation is, what their everyday life is like, the consequences of being a prostitute and having the charge of prostitution by your name. And the fees that the men pay to go to this workshop actually go to services that support local prostitutes in the area. So I highly think that's a good alternative for people to look into and support. Hopefully that continues to grow. But yeah, there's, you know, I think you said you had read the book, and do you remember the part? I didn't actually get to meet Neil Malamuth. He's a UCLA professor, but I had some correspondence with him about a study he did in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence. And he talked about how they did a study where they actually asked men to describe how they viewed prostitutes. And they actually, several men said that it was sort of like going to Starbucks and getting a cup of coffee. Because you wanted the coffee, go get the coffee. And when you're done, you just discard the refuse. You know, you discard just what you don't want. And they viewed the prostitutes the same way. And the study was essentially to you know, see the correlation between that and violence toward prostitutes, which is something I also discussed a little bit in the book. But that really hit home for me, because I think I know that a lot of Johns feel that way, but the solution to that is not something that we're going to be able to completely fix with changes in the law.
Yeah, that seems like something on a deep psychological level that we've been able to mentally turn women into essentially commerce, just like another product to be used and thrown away. That seems like there's some studies that need to take place and figure out, you know, and a lot of that could and probably does stem from just the way that, that men are raised in society or have been traditionally. That's, oh, wow.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, can I, if you don't mind, I want to use the example of Lenora Frago. Do you remember that story at all?
Yeah, by all means, by all means.
Yeah, because, you know, so she was a woman who had offered escort services on the internet. Now, she said that she did not necessarily offer sex, but that's obviously something that's insinuated, for $150. So in 2009, on Christmas Eve, a man in Texas hired her for $150. And when she got there, she felt uncomfortable, refused to have sex with him. And when she was leaving, he actually shot at her and her driver and hit her in the neck. So she later died from those injuries. And the case went to court. And there's a law in Texas that allows for a person to violently defend their property. So his attorney argued that because she had stolen $150, essentially, and not offered the service, that he should be acquitted, and he was acquitted. And it's so when I heard that, I thought that to me, that tells me the way, at least, the jury viewed her life. And I wondered if it was just me, maybe because I'm so wrapped up in this documentary, maybe I don't see this the way other people did. So we went out on the street and asked people, and the distinction between the way men and women viewed the story was amazing to me. Because, you know, for example, if you, in the documentary, you see two young girls, who are Vanderbilt students, and we just asked them, hey, if a man, let's say, buys a prostitute and she refuses to have sex with him, if he forces her, so if he rapes her, would you still consider that rape? And they obviously said, yes, I would still consider that rape. And then we asked a man the same question 5 minutes later, and he said that it would not be rape because it was part of the transaction. And it just took me back to this whole idea that if a woman is working as a prostitute, she is no longer human. Like, she's lost the entitlement that we would typically assume a human being would have because of that situation she's in. And we didn't want it. We just felt like it's not, we didn't leave that in the documentary to just point out that this guy, you know, is a bad guy or anything like that. We just wanted people to understand the process of dehumanizing someone in sex work, let's say. You've got fire running through your veins. Don't let it die out. Don't let it die out. Deep inside you burns the sacred flame.
Yeah, it seems like education is a huge component of this for not only the common person out there in society and the way that they view prostitution and just the lack of understanding that we have just in terms of how so many women get involved in prostitution, but then also, as you mentioned earlier, the police department needing better education on how to approach and handle those situations. But then there's also this third component that kept popping up, and there were some horrific stories about this as well, just in terms of just the dangers that these women face, many of whom are in these situations against their will, but from both the Johns and the pimps. And so you highlight some instances where, you know, these prostitutes are ending up murdered, you know, and then obviously even more are badly beaten. There's the one woman in the documentary who is kind of showing off a scar in her neck and had said that, you know, she can't feel anything in her chin. And like, so talk about that aspect of it too, just the sheer amount of danger these women are in on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think that's, well, you know, that ties into the police education as well, because, you know, more than one woman that I spoke with mentioned that when they would go to the police after they were beaten by a John or a pimp or whoever, they were often told, this is just part of your job, right? I mean, you know that this is something that's going to happen to you when you work as a prostitute. There was definitely a lack of sensitivity. The other thing that I think was really hard to hear, because, you know, if you hear somebody say something, it might just be their opinion, but when you hear it time after time after time, you think it's probably true. It's probably a consistent thing. And almost every woman told us that the perspective of a John is that you cannot rape a prostitute. And it's hard to hear that when you talk to somebody and realize that they were still somebody's daughter, you know, still somebody's sister. It's really hard to hear that. And it doesn't really, there seems to be, I think everybody knows that prostitutes are more at risk for violence. I think the type of violence is something people aren't aware of. You know, the idea that they might be beaten by pimps is one thing, but, you know, if you remember in the documentary, there was a moment where Kelly Alsobrook talked about one of her good friends who was also a prostitute, and she went to Washington, D.C. with a guy that she had a bad feeling about, and he killed her. There was another girl who told us about finding one of her friends beheaded, you know. And then even in situations where the woman that I spoke with, who is still working, or at least was still working as an escort when we talked, talked about how twice in her time as a prostitute, someone had attempted to kill her. Both times somebody pulled a knife from behind a couch when she walked into the room. Which is just, I mean, it's terrifying to think about, because they weren't even interested in, you know, they literally called her for the purpose of wanting to kill someone, you know? Mm. It's bad. And that thing, I feel like there's definitely things that we can do, and there's solutions to a lot of this. And with the police department, there's a lot of ways that we can help. And a lot of ways they can do things better, but things like that, I don't know what the, you know, sort of quick solution is to making those women safer.
Yeah. One of the ideas that you brought up in the book, I believe it was this argument that's been around for a while. And it's obviously controversial, which is just legalizing prostitution. And, you know, obviously with the idea that if it's legal, then it can be above board, and therefore making the women who engage in it safer. Talk a little bit about kind of the pros and cons to what that might do.
Well, I think, you know, the pros are that if we do legalize prostitution, we at least have some type of accountability system for everybody who's out there working. Oftentimes in countries where they have, you know, given this a chance, I think, what is it, the Nordic model? Is that the one that I talked about in the book, I believe?
They had
found some success in making the situation safer, for prostitutes. I think the only thing to me there's several issues, but I guess to me, the biggest thing, about legalizing prostitution is, I think I don't see it as being the same as legalizing marijuana, for example. You know, where I think there, over time, maybe people attach less of the stigma to you know, the use of marijuana. That's certainly possible, like with alcohol, with smoking. But I think because of the type of work that prostitution is, because of the way that we've seen consistently, if we allowed prostitution to be legalized across the board, then we've actually taken the step to make it a commodity. I think right now there's certainly a part of it that allows for men to commodify women in our society in general. And we see it in a lot of places. But I think when you take that step, we've actually done it. And it's something that I don't think is great for the psychological health for a lot of those women. I think it sounds good. And in practice, it's worked out in terms of safety. But I think there's a psychological aspect to it that those women won't benefit from having the practice legalized long term, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Completely. Yeah. And actually, I'm glad you brought up the psychological aspect, because one of the things I want to hear you talk about a little bit is just the aftercare part of it. And just how important that is. Cause I remember in the documentary, one of the women talking about the fact that, you know, it's been years since she got out of the sex trafficking trade and is still, unpacking that and dealing with it, through therapy and that sort of thing. So talk about that aspect of it. Like the kind of care that we really don't have set up right now, but that these women are absolutely going to need.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, on that subject, did you see the scene where I asked it? The woman, the attorney who works for the DA office, she said these women need a ton of aftercare that they don't receive. And I said, like what? And she almost yelled at me because, she listed out. She said, well, let me ask you something. She's like, you think about, you know, can you imagine if there was an insurance that paid for the care of sex trafficking survivors? You know, I was like, no, I would never think about it. You know, she said, there's the care that you would provide to someone who, has been traumatically raped. It would take years and likely a lifetime to recover from that psychologically. So what she said to me is, imagine now a woman who's raped 10 times a day for 20 years. And what do you think it will take for her to get back on her feet? Because there's the psychological component of the need for counseling. Potentially she needs drug therapy. And then what about where she's living? You know, does she have any housing options? Where is she going to work? Who is going to feel comfortable hiring her if all they know about her is that she was a prostitute before? I mean, these are all big issues. You know, and Tuan mentioned to me something, I said this earlier when I was talking to you, but it never occurred to me that there are women working as prostitutes who also are providing for children, you know, have kids at home. And if they are potentially involved with a violent pimp or something like that, and they want to get out of that lifestyle, where do they go? Because there aren't shelters really that offer. I mean, there may be shelters that will take her and her children, but shelters that will provide all of those services in terms of long-term care, they don't really exist. I mean, it's certainly something that we could do a better job of providing for. But yeah, I mean, it's a very intense process. And what I think I found is that because there's not a lot of services, many of these women just sort of have to work through it over the next decade, and then they're still dealing with it. But, you know, programs like the John School, I think, are a good option to provide some of the financing for that, which is another argument you could say for not completely decriminalizing or legalizing prostitution, because if you legalize, then obviously it's legal. You're not going to have the ability to take John's and force them to pay for services. It is a complicated issue to recover from being a sex trafficking survivor.
Gosh, that it goes back to, I've always been a huge proponent of mental health and mental health services. And just the fact that, especially in the United States, it's so, it's not great. Not to say that the counselors aren't great, but the ability to get the care that you need oftentimes is so expensive that even a person with a decent job has troubles being able to go as often as they probably need to. And then we're talking about women who are barely making ends meet, who have, you know, copious amounts of trauma that they need to they need to go to this therapist for. And, you know, it's just, again, yet another example of an area where the system is not set up to help.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And the other thing is this idea that, you know, they're bringing nothing to the table. Because most of the time, you know, if a pimp is in charge of finances, it's not like they have a savings that they can pull from to even start that counseling process.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I want to make sure that we mention, you have this statistic at the end of the book that I think is definitely worth hearing and definitely worth mentioning, just because I think it opens a lot of eyes in terms of how big of an issue this really is and how it needs more attention. It needs more resources. It needs more creative ideas and ways to solve this issue. You talk about at the end of the book, the global sex trade is the fastest growing form of commerce, worth $32 billion annually. And it's estimated that the United States alone generates $9.8 billion of that and involves at least 100,000 children. That's staggering.
Yeah. The part at the end is to me the most staggering. I think, you know, like you said at the beginning, and I had the perception coming in that there are definitely, you know, Americans who travel to Thailand and, you know, purchase prostitutes and things like that. But the amount of children in our country who are susceptible, and we just very recently in the last few months, you know, there was a big, push on social media where people were talking about for the first time the number of missing children in the United States. And I think it's hard for us to really pin down where a lot of them end up, but the statistics do back up. I think 800,000 of the missing children in the U.S. will end up in some form of prostitution. And a big portion of that too, that I mentioned in the book, not a big portion, but the most susceptible group are like LGBTQ+ kids. Because, you know, like we talked about, you know, if kids don't feel welcome at home or they're kicked out of their house, what options do they have? And then somebody comes along and is like, hey, you can make money here, maybe sells them, you know, whatever their dreams are, that they'll be able to travel, that they'll be able to make money, you know, buy the things they want. And then they're in these horrible situations.
Well, I don't want to bum people out completely. This is obviously a very heavy topic, but very important. So I want to leave them on more of a positive note, which is what can we, because I know people out there who are listening, their hearts are breaking by listening to these stories. And so what can we do? What can the people at home do to help fight against human trafficking?
Oh man, John, I feel kind of bad now because I realize that a lot of your listeners do get a lot of encouragement from your podcast. But I think there's a lot of things we can do. For me personally, I think everybody who hears these stories has to do a little self-evaluation and ask themselves, you know, whether or not they personally commodify women. because it's something that I realized was much more deeply ingrained in myself than I had ever thought. I think, you know, one thing that people could really do is educate yourself, educate others on how much of an issue it is, that it really is. Be open to supporting people who are really doing the work in whatever way you can. You know, if it's financial and you can donate some money to one of these organizations, that's great. If you can write your senator, your congressman, let them know, you know, what you'd like to see changed, particularly if they live somewhere where there's not some form of a safe harbor law. I mean, that would be fantastic, just to give those women a chance to have their records cleared.
Yeah, that's such a crucial part of this, I think, is just really attacking it from all sides. I think number one, obviously, keeping this in the public forum, making sure that this is an issue that doesn't just fade away, and that is still that stays and remains in the public consciousness. And then I think obviously also there's a huge educational component to this, as on top of, you know, obviously changing laws or creating laws that that help eliminate the situation. But I can't thank you enough for coming on. I definitely want to give a plug here for both your book and your film. The book is called The Outcast Daughter: What I Learned About Hope and Faith from Conversations with Sex Trafficking Survivors. And then the film, the documentary, is called Irreclaimable. So where can people get a copy of the book, and where can people go to see the film?
Okay, so the book you can find pretty much anywhere that you buy books. You can get it on Amazon, iTunes. It's on the publisher's website at Covenant Books. And then the documentary, I think the best place to watch the documentary right now is Amazon Prime. We had recently been on DirecTV, but I think Amazon Prime is probably the best place to find it right now.
Perfect. Well, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fascinating documentary. Like I said, at times very, very hard to watch. You know, and some of the stories are just gut-wrenching, but I think it's necessary, and it's something that people need to educate themselves on in order for us to take action and do something about it. So thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for taking some time to come on the show tonight.
Yeah, thank you, John. I'm with you. I think it's great for people to be able to see it and just see that, you know, it is bad, but one of the ways that God often moves is through people, and we can make those situations better if we're just willing to just open to it.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, and you know, have a great night, and thank you again for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you, John. I appreciate it. Keep the chemicals out of my oxygen. Keep the GMO out of my bloodstream. Keep the oil fields into war machine. Must we be the first and the strongest? Industry and military complex. You can't take the profits out of context. You can't love mercy if you love conquest. I'm not joking here. Strongman said, let's steal the oil and cheer him on. Strongman said, let's scorch the soil of the children. A strongman, why you celebrate the talk of war crimes that don't belong? Man, I'm not a fan of barrel bombs and landmines. Demigods like demagogues, like warlords and white collar frauds. In New York suits on camouflage. Either way, it looks the same. It's a corruption, it's a con job. Why are we so going toxic from the start? It's oil and not blood flowing through your dark heart. Earth to justice here. They're just profiteers. Special interests got their ears.
but we need our opiates and our titanium. We displace the masses for cocaine and uranium. Building industry on the backs of the exiles and the enslaved. Textiles just like tobacco in the good old days. Is this a blood diamond? I can't sell the old. Blooding in the rosary in my cell phone. How did we accumulate such wealth? Well, the war criminals myself. Oh.
Like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.